that probably HP wouldn't need us as badly, you know, if EI were to sell this operation, if we're sold to Hewlett Packard, you know, that would, we didn't know what our, you know, I didn't know what the status would be for the people in the company.
Okay.
Because we're now a fairly significant number of people.
About how many would you approximate?
I'd say probably 50,
right,
something like that. And I felt that, you know, HP would probably cherry pick, you know,
uh-huh,
the people, and they wouldn't, and so it wouldn't be, for them, they probably in any area would have other people who could take over these jobs. And I had already followed other companies that had been acquired by them and, you know, seen the outcome. And HP is always a fair company, but if they had better capability in-house, they would use
right,
those people. And so it appeared to us that we would be, if we went to Syntex, we would, you know, be kept as a unit,
right,
and really, you know, be able to control our own destiny quite a bit more, because Syntex didn't have analytical instrument division. And in the dealing with Syntex, I met Roger Sant, who was their chief of finance for Syntex Research, and Roger and I formed an immediate friendship.
Mm.
And really, I trusted him right from the beginning, and felt that we would probably be working together if we were acquired by Syntex. Roger and I would probably be the two that they would look to direct it. And they would, at that time we were from EAI looking to move across the street from Syntex in Stanford,
mm,
Industrial Park.
Mm-hmm.
And we were considering a building, because we were doing quite well financially. In 66, we made, with $2.5 million in sales, we made more money than all of EAI put together, and they were probably at $50 million in sales.
Wow.
At that time, maybe more than that. But they were doing very poorly on the bottom line.
Hmm.
And so I would say that probably was one of the reasons they were interested in selling the operation, that they weren't really all that committed to doing analytical instruments, and they could sell it for a premium, because
right,
if they got 20 or 30 times profits, it would have been a very profitable sale for them.
Now, so Syntex begins to, you know, as you're talking to Roger Sant, they're getting very forthright about wanting to acquire the division. EAI seems favorably disposed to do a deal like that. Did Hewlett Packard know that was in the offing? Did they make an offer to?
No, they hadn't. At this point, they were looking at the product, waiting for delivery, and we delivered actually the very last day of 66. So they didn't have the product.
Okay.
And I would just say that they were sniffing around, I guess is the right word. You know, we would have, one day I had the vice president of Noah Elder, the vice president of marketing and sales, visit. The next day would be the vice president of manufacturing, and was ultimately meeting just about all the top echelon at HP. And at that time, they were sort of functionally organized, where Hewlett and Packard had these key guys under them, and all of those people came over, but neither Bill nor Dave came over to visit,
mm-hmm,
at this point. And I would say, you know, we talked probably about possible OEM arrangement or other things. And I would say I don't think HP stated forthrightly that they wanted to acquire the division. They wanted the product. They wanted to work with us with the product, but they were also being careful not to compromise themselves So if they want to build their own product, you know, they can do that. And Don Hammond is his name.
Don Hammond.
Don Hammond was one of the principals at HP Labs. And Don he started a project up there at HP Labs on the quadrupole in this very same time period.
After visiting, and so they probably wanted to see what they could do.
Right.
Okay.
Exactly.
And you talked about being, you know, you had this immediate rapport and trust with Roger Sant. What did you also have meetings with Gerassi and Zaffaroni?
Yeah, and Rosencrantz as well.
And Rosencrantz.
I met all of them. We met for lunch and spent some time talking about it, and I would just say I think they left it to Roger and Ken Hansen, their VP of Corporate Development, and to decide, you know, what they should do and how much it was worth. And there was a lot of effort spent looking at the patent situation on the quadrupole. Being a pharmaceutical firm, placed a lot of value on patents.
Right.
And there was a patent situation in where Professor Paul had a valid patent in Germany, but he had published too soon in the U.S. and before filing for the patent.
Oh.
And so it was not patentable in the U.S.
Because of that prior publication.
Right. Yeah. And it's only a matter of a few days, but nevertheless, it made their patent in the U.S., which they filed for, invalid. And it was never really tested, as far as I know, but they didn't. Siemens, I think, bought it, and they didn't really ever claim it was valid.
Now, did the Syntex folks find that to be favorable or unfavorable in terms of looking at the quad?
I think, well, they obviously found it favorable that the major market wasn't patented by a company in Germany.
Right, but on the other hand, you didn't have a lock on exclusivity.
Right, exactly.
If you had,
yeah, and so that probably for them was unfavorable
looking
at it from that end. And but we had no patents at EAI that we had filed for, and it was all SRI know-how, so it was in the public domain, so there was no use. And we're really building the SRI quadrupole. And so we didn't, and we weren't sensitive at that point to the whole patent idea. And I think we realized that it was, that it was probably not worth a lot of effort for us at that time, as opposed to just taking the football and running.
Right.
So I guess in this period, we're doing extremely well selling as fast as we could build them. We're selling them, making a really good profit. We had this strong interest from Syntex, which was somewhat destabilizing in the organization, in that some people didn't want to work for Syntex or didn't know exactly what it would mean for them. And we didn't publicize it. It was pretty late in the game, like October of that year, I think, before I got the whole organization together and told them, because we had people working analog computer stuff and, you know, people working on various different things. During this period, Euthy left.
Oh.
Euthy and Greenan and Lauren Wright, all three, who were three key guys, they left, and I think to form a company called Euthy Technology, UTI, as I don't know what it's known as, to build solid state electronics for the semiconductor industry. And I would say there was some of it was the feeling that they didn't want to be part of Syntex, you know, of a subsidiary of Syntex, whatever it would become. And part of it was just unrest
And for those three.
For those three, wanting to do their own thing, I guess you'd call it. And not feeling that they could, you know, and it's, you know, something that's pretty, at that time was more unusual in the Valley than it is now today. It wouldn't even raise any eyebrows. Yeah. But it was very disturbing to me, because Yuthi right. was my right hand. We'd been together a long time.
Right.
And he basically did it without giving any advance warning, and to take our manufacturing manager and engineering, key engineering, yeah. Key double E, with him was really, you know, almost an act of war. And it was worrisome, but I had brought in other people from Livermore, in fact, who had worked for me or with me at Livermore to become part of this, and it turns out that one of them, Bob Marshall, was a far better engineering manager than Dick Greenan, and he was working in he's far better manufacturing manager. Mm-hmm. He was working in engineering at the time Greenan left, and
right.
and quickly saw that he would be an outstanding manager, and he's manufacturing manager at Tandem and several other firms, and he's became a very successful person in the Valley. He ultimately is a multimillionaire sort of person.
Right.
And had another fellow, Gordon Nelson, who worked for me at the lab, who became the chief electronic guy and had other people. So we recovered, but losing Mike Yuthi was a big blow for me.
And that's in late 66, before, you know, so since they're key people, they know about the talks with Syntex.
So. Right, yeah. And that, I think, it destabilized the organization
right.
in many, in that it went on for about 8 or 9 months.
Mm.
And, you know, and it's the sort of thing most companies would have done in a couple of months' time. You know, they would have either said yes or no.
Right.
And because you can't keep it secret after, you know, a certain period of time. Everybody, you know, they see all these people coming in and looking over the, you know, the operation and so on. And so they formed UTI, and ultimately they made a quadrupole mass spectrometer
yeah.
for the semiconductor industry to be used in looking at cleanliness in vacuum
mm-hmm.
systems
mm-hmm.
and so on. And they built a good quadrupole. And I would say during this period, I recognized that there was a limit to the RGA market, and that, you know, it's probably 2 or 3 million a year, which is what we were selling. And I was looking, you know, I was carefully looking for, you know, the growth, you know, where was it going to come from?
Right.
And didn't really see where it was going to grow that much more. And there were competitors like Varian coming in. And I guess I became aware from Carl Gerassi, first off, of GCMS market. And then started doing my own looking and became aware that could become a sizable market. And I guess dealing with HP as well, you know, and seeing their interest in the mass spec for their GC. All of these sort of added up to, you know, here it's a zero market today, but, you know, there was one company, LKB, selling a GCMS at that time, and they
right.
just introduced it in
and that
the
was
US.
the only one out there, right.
right.
And so that was Syntex's interest, was to, you know, acquire the division, keep the very profitable RGA business going, but look to develop the GCMS. I mean, that was their
yeah,
idea.
I think that's, we hadn't talked so much about it, but that was my goal.
Right.
And I think they agreed with that.
Right.
And they really wanted an analytical, Carl Gerassi wanted an analytical instrument operation within Syntex, because they call it Jurassic's electric training. and I think there was some truth to that.
Huh.
And I guess through this, it becomes somewhat of a self-fulfilling prophecy. And you have to change that.
Oh, no, I was just, sorry, just yeah. fiddling with the
nut. In that, you know, I had pushed on EAI to go, as you know, pointing out the GCMS market and saying this is what we want to do and this is what it's going to cost. And the cost wasn't going to be all that much, but we needed to have a collaboration with a GC company,
mm-hmm.
and we needed to make our own GC, which probably wasn't in our thinking. But we needed money to develop the joint product. And EAI as a company was really hurting. They had been working on hybrid digital analog computers, mm-hmm. and were becoming unprofitable. And we were the only part of the company making money. And they never said, you can't do it, but they never would approve of us, you know, doing that. And it would take a sales force that was different from theirs, and they were against hiring salesmen. They knew how expensive it was
right.
going to be. And so EAI was quietly, you know, sort of sitting and hoping that they could sell it off. But it was not lost on me or on others in the organization that their interest in this, you know, had diminished,
mm-hmm.
and that certain places along the way, I personally had to decide, did I want to be with Syntex or EAI? And EAI had earlier offered, they wanted me to move back to Long Branch, wanted me to be vice president. They were considering me for vice president of operations. And I told them I wasn't interested in it. And I didn't go back to interview for the job. They sent the chief of personnel out here to talk to me. And I ultimately told them that I didn't want to leave the Bay Area and that was that. And which was not a very good thing, you know, when the president of the company had sent him out here. And I said, I just don't want to waste your time because I'm not interested, you know, and I wouldn't leave here. I have ties, family ties, and so on and so forth, and I like the company and all that, but I don't want the job, and I don't want to move. And that was not taken very kindly. But I felt, you know, like I might as well be honest and not go through all the rigmarole,
right.
and they make me the job offer, and I say, you know, I really don't want it. But I probably wasn't very shrewd in, you know, how I went about it. But I was, I guess I was at a point where I just didn't want to do it. And I'd been going back and forth enough that I really knew the lay of the land.
Right.
But that also took place during this period. And so it wound up with me on a limb that I was quickly sawing off. And because when it, and ultimately, in Syntex decided not to go through with the purchase of this, and it wasn't Jurassic or Zaffroni. It was, they had three lawyers on their board.
Hmm.
The company that owned them was a firm back east, Allen and Company, really were the primary shareholders. And held three positions on the board and controlled the board. And they didn't see that it made any sense at all. And they're the ones that called it Jurassic's electric train. And they ultimately killed it just by dragging it out and keep asking for more information and this and that.
Mm-hmm.
So it sometime like October, November, it died. And
November 66.
Okay. Right. And so I was really at that point, I think I had sawed the limb off where I really felt that I couldn't continue to work. I didn't see any future for the GCMS product at EAI. I saw they really needed the money we were making to keep the company going. And so there was as I saw it, you know, it was not a retrievable situation. And so I resigned in the end, the last day of 66, resigned from the company. And I tried, before that, I had tried to buy this operation. I had relations with bank and various individuals who were willing to put up money and had proposed to the board at EAI that they sell it to us, the people in the company, and to people.
Right.
One of them was Union Bank and Palo Alto and various other individuals, and said that, you know, I said, you know, we would keep them half, they would own half of it or something of that order. And they really didn't appreciate that. I mean, at that time, this was a conservative Eastern company, and, you know, and it was sort of, they interpreted it as a gun to their head, and which it wasn't really meant to be at all. But it ultimately would have probably been to their great benefit if they had done it. But they didn't see it that way, and they just said no, they weren't interested in doing that, and they were going to initiate sale of it to either Varian or HP. And so I resigned in the end of 66 and left to form Finnegan with Roger Sant. Had asked me, as I in one of my papers, I think he asked me what I would do before he told me what the outcome was going to be at Syntex, but I could see it sort of coming. What would you do if it falls through? And I said, well, I think I would like to start my own company, and if I can find backing and pursue that. And so he said he would like to be involved with me and help to raise money and become involved on the financial end. And as it turned out, there were several venture capitalists that came and wanted to fund Finnegan, but I had decided that I really did want to work with Roger, and T.Z. Chu, who was willing to put up some money and offered, you know, I could say, offered a great prospect, you know, as a CEO, general manager person. And so I resigned and turned the thing over to EAI, and they sent somebody out from one branch who was going to be the overall manager, and then the fellow that I brought from Livermore, Gordon Nelson, became general manager, whom I recommended him, and they made him general manager of the operation here in Palo Alto.
I have just a couple quick questions on that. Did you talk with key people in the group about your thoughts, you know, before you resigned, and your thoughts about, I mean, when you resigned, if I'm understanding correctly, you know, you did have the thought of, well, I'll start a company. My next step will be to try and put together a company to do the GCMS. Did you talk to, you know, key people in the group?
Yeah.
Had you tried to get them on board? Or?
Well, it was sort of a touchy thing, and then, you know, you don't want to recruit. You know, I didn't feel it was ethical for me to be recruiting people while I'm, you know, for a new company while I'm at EAI.
Right.
And so I didn't. I talked to the whole group about, you know, the outcome at Syntex, and of course everyone wanted to know what's going to happen, you know, now that that's fallen through, because a lot of them were counting on that, and as, you know, a good opportunity.
Right.
And so I said, you know, I felt that the company, I couldn't answer for the company, but I felt that they would probably want to find somebody else to step up to the plate, that they had, you know, no ambitions in the analytical instrument area, for instance, and beyond RGA. I was it, you know.
Right.
And so I didn't talk to anybody. I resigned I wrote it out longhand and sent it to the person I was working for, Fred Martinson, who was a close friend. And I sent it to him and said I would be gone in 2 weeks. If they wanted me sooner, I'd be gone sooner. Mm. And then a number of the people approached me as soon as I was gone.
Okay.
And they also recognized, you know, that it was sort of a touchy thing. And Mike Story was the first. And a guy named Dick Hine, who was a close associate, he was a chemist as well. And I had already decided that I would go back to SRI and get Bill Feese. And I had talked to him before I left, in fact, to see if he would be interested. And he said he would be. And he was the key electrical engineer at SRI on the Quadripole project. Really a genius.
Mm.
And I picked up on that while I was at SRI. And I was sort of saving him in case we ever had to do something different. I was glad he hadn't been the one selected to work at, you know, to do the work at EAI building the quads. And so Bill was the key guy. I felt that Bill and Mike and I could do it, the three of us could do it, and with Roger as providing the financial initiative. And so I had, within maybe a week of leaving EAI, had both Bill and Mike signed up. And I took Dick Hine as well, because Mike felt that we needed him, and he wanted to leave. And I would say EAI was probably glad to be rid of Mike and Dick. Maybe not so much Mike, but the person in charge, Gordon Nelson, who had been my number two man at Livermore for 4 years or so, he and Mike didn't get along.
Mm.
And I would say, Gordon, I think, perhaps wanted to join us at Finnegan, but I really didn't feel he was the right person. And you get into this business where EAI are, you know, sending you letters saying if you take anybody, we're going to meet you in court.
Mm.
And they sent me a letter more or less to that, expressing those sentiments and saying if we're going to build quadripoles, that we're going to meet in court. And I wrote him a letter back, which we had a lawyer already at Finnegan, and he read, but he didn't change a single word. In which I said, you know, I brought the quadripole from SRI to EAI, not the other way around. You know, that they learned of it from me, and I had worked on it at SRI, and most of what I knew, I had learned at SRI. And it was nothing proprietary. We were building the SRI quadripole. And we made no bones about it. We told the world that.
Mm.
We didn't have a single patent. We, you know, used the same subs that SRI had, and so on. And so I pointed this out in a letter, and never did hear again from them, one way or another. They never said, you know, you have our blessing. And we really didn't intend to do the same things as we had done there.
Yeah. Two questions just to tie off some ends. One question, and feel free not to answer this if you don't want to, is, you know, you had this close collaborative relationship with Mike Youthy, and, you know, with that rupture in 66 and his departure, did that also sever your personal, you know, was that work break in professional relationship, a break in a personal relationship too?
Yeah. I think it isn't like I didn't ever forgive him, but he was working behind my back, so to speak, and people were telling me, so I was aware of it.
Right.
But and that he did this without any warning at all, and I had, we had some problems earlier but I had kept him on at his request as a consultant, but a full-time consultant.
Mm.
And I would say I think I really was pretty, you know, I saw that his help was needed and so on, and so it wasn't all, you know, because I was a great guy.
Right.
But I was really generous in accommodating him and, you know, and asking him not to work behind my back and you know, sort of undermine the things
mm-hmm.
that we were both trying to do as, you know, as a company and as part of the company. And so there were some events prior to that, but I was, I would say at the point where he left, I didn't see where, you know, there was a lot of room for continuation of friendship, because it was a very close friendship.
Right.